Hello and welcome to the final episode of season two. To the hundreds of you that are continuing to download and listen to this podcast week in, week out, you have no idea how much your continued support of this podcast means, not just to me, but actually the other hundreds of listeners who are basically fueling this podcast week in, week out. Without you, we wouldn't do this. It's that simple. If we didn't now have an audience, why would we do this? But your continued support, your listenership, and bringing to life, messaging us week in, week out about your experiences of men's mental health is just amazing. So I want to thank each and every one of you. We are so, so grateful to have your time and your ears each week. We've done almost 20 episodes in season two. I mean, 20 episodes, unbelievable. We've covered such a broad range of topics around men's mental health as well, including and not limited to grief, depression, bipolar disorder, dystonia, eating disorders, body dysmorphia, anxiety, suicide, suicide ideation, and loads more. I mean, the list is quite remarkable. We've been completely blessed to have an unbelievable 19 guests, including Alistair Campbell, Premier League footballer Joe Bryan, TV presenter Simon Thomas, extreme adventurer Luke Bursky, England rugby player Denny Solomona, Luke Chadwick, former Manchester United winger, the remarkable dystonia sufferer James Sutcliffe, and so many more. We could go through all 19 names. Thank you so much to everybody who's tuned in. We are very excited for what's to come, but before I announce that, a massive thank you to our partners in the previous episodes in Cornerstone. But thank you to the continued support of Looseheads, the mental health rugby charity, who will be continuing to sponsor this podcast in season three too. Yes, you heard that right. A season three with some very, very, very interesting and exciting new guests, bearing all to explore men's mental health even further. I'm going to let you into a little secret now. The first guest in season three is probably the forerunner in terms of leading electronic music in the 90s. And he recorded one of the most iconic songs of the 90s, and he is on this podcast to bear all. Season three, it's not far away. I want to finish this season with a remarkable human being, a genuinely remarkable man. Ben Smith, who was featured on BBC Three's Amazing Humans, is the man who ran 401 marathons, yes, 401 marathons in 401 days. And he is on the show today to tell his story. There isn't much more of an intro needed, actually. So, Ben Smith, welcome to The Rut. As always, please leave all judgment at the door. Ben, welcome to The Rut. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me.
No problem. It's I saw you on BBC News. God, I saw, when you first completed the 401 challenge, I was like, who is this slightly lanky bearded guy who's just ran 401 marathons in 401 days and in complete awe? And I was like, wow, okay. And lo and behold, 4 years later, we are here on my podcast and talking about mental health and 401 and whatever. So thank you for joining us.
No, thanks for having me, mate. Thank you. And I look very different back then to what I look like now. Yeah, let's just put it that way. So yeah. I put on some weight, which is probably a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Ben, I ask everybody who comes on the podcast why they wanted to share their story and come on and talk. What's your reason for doing it other than me begging Helen, your assistant?
To be honest with you, I think it's in the title of what your podcast is about. You know, it's getting men talking. Mm. You know, I've been very, very lucky and very privileged to do hundreds of talks, both here in the UK and around the world, not just to kind of corporates, but primary schools and secondary schools and lots of different audiences. And I think one of the kind of major things that's kind of come out through the feedback is a man being able to share his deepest, darkest moments in his life is actually quite a powerful and emotive thing. And it's almost a freeing thing. You know, there's this stereotype around men that we should be very strong, we should be very masculine, we should be, you know, we shouldn't really talk about our feelings because we're there to protect everyone. And actually, do you know what those stereotypes are? They're dead. They're dead. You know, we can be strong, we can be free by talking about things. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to come on here and talk openly about the experiences I've been through in the past, because I think if anybody can kind of take from what I've learned and what I've been through and use that in a positive way to affect them, then that's got to be a good thing, right?
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, 100%. Let's go back to the very start. You were, and I've done a lot of research on you.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny that one thing people say when they come is like, you've done a lot of research. I was like, yeah, I mean, it's important. Anyway, you came from a military, your parents were both in the military, right?
Yeah.
I listened to a TED talk you did, and actually what you said was you went to boarding school, if I'm right, at the age of
10,
and you felt like you didn't fit in. Mm-hmm. I just want to go back before that, because in that TED talk, you talk about this, this lost confidence, self-esteem, you became shy before you, just as you arrived. That means there was a change before the bullying even started.
Yeah, definitely. You know, growing up, I was very lucky. I was born into a family with two parents that absolutely loved me, adored me. They wanted nothing but the best for me. And, you know, I know how lucky I am to have that. And I still have that. You know, they gave me this ability to be who I wanted to be. They filled me with confidence and self-esteem. They pushed me beyond my limits at certain times. You know, being part of a military family, it meant we get to travel the world quite a lot. And we got to immerse myself in different cultures, learn different languages, meet different types of people. And it was a very open-minded experience, especially for the first 10 years of my life. You know, I was joined by my brother a couple of years later, and we were thick as thieves. it was amazing. And I think, you know, I'd never really heard of boarding school. I'd never really heard of, you know, going away to school. It was me, my mum, my dad, my brother, and that was it. But unfortunately, at the age of 10, things did change because my dad got a promotion and he ended up working as the RAF liaison officer to NATO in Germany. And then we moved out to Germany. But unfortunately, there wasn't the schooling after a particular age for British kids. So what that meant was I had to go to boarding school. Mm. And as I said, never really knew what it was. There was no Harry Potter back when I was, 10 years old. This is 1992. I'm sure that was probably a speck in JK's eye at that point. But I viewed it like anything else. I viewed it as an adventure. And when I arrived in the school, I quickly realized that actually the school was very different to anything I'd ever been in before.
In what way?
Situation. It was just, I think the best way to describe it is that there was like a mile-long drive up to this school and it was tree-lined. And then when you hit the bottom of this drive, this almost massive Gothic house just opens up out of the middle of nowhere. Now, I'd never really seen anything like that. No. And it wasn't like it suddenly became very homely. It just looked cold. And it was a cold winter's night when we were there. And anyway, I remember getting left and that first night, I just remember thinking to myself, yeah, this doesn't feel right. I couldn't put my finger on it. Mm. You know, I've been brought up by my parents to value people, to value experiences, to value, you know, the things I could learn in life. Whereas a lot of the kids I went to school with, they valued things like types of cars their mum and dad drove or, you know, the clothes that they had, the money that their parents owned. And it almost became this materialistic thing that was valued. And, you know, I was able to kind of overcome that for a little bit of time because, you know, my parents had instilled in me for 10 years that, you know, you live by your own mind. But after relentlessly being told by people that the way I thought was wrong, that gets to you. Of course it gets to you. And you start to think and become something that you didn't know you were. And I suppose I changed, and that's when I went from being a very outgoing person to being quite shy and I suppose doing things for other people because all I wanted them to do was to like me.
And what were you doing? Because it resonates very highly with me.
It was just stuff like I was a bit of a class clown and, you know, I'd always be scared most days, to be honest with you, because I started to get bullied and because I was different and, you know, most people were probably been through similar things, but, you know, there was this almost kind of like lack of understanding around difference. And because I was, you know, a little bit more sensitive than, say, some of the other kids, because that had been instilled in me by my parents, and, you know, I thought about others rather than just myself. It wasn't cutthroat. I think a lot of the insecurities of the kids that I went to school with came out in the form of, do you know what, I feel bad, so therefore I'm going to make him feel even worse. So, but obviously at the time, you don't see it like that.
No, you don't see it like
that at all. So anyway, it just manifested itself in typical name calling and being, you know, books being, you know, the stereotypical stuff like books being knocked out of my hands or being ostracized. And, you know, I'd sit down at the table and then everybody would get up and walk away. You know, that stuff that you see in the movies, basically.
Yeah.
Like, it makes you feel like crap.
Yeah. And you're not good enough.
Yeah, that was it.
I want to talk about how the feeling of not being good enough manifests itself into your life, because it's something I still struggle now. And on my Instagram, I talk about quite a lot, is this underlying feeling of not being good enough. And it percolates into all these different areas. It's like it's like an octopus with tentacles going into my personal life, my professional life. And it's just this underlying nagging feeling. What does that feel like to you?
Oh, it's imposter syndrome, isn't it? It's kind of, you know, I've done some pretty amazing things that I'm extremely proud of in my life, and, you know, and I can near enough tell you at every single point there's been that feeling in the back of my head going, I don't belong here, or I don't deserve to be here, you know. And excuse for dropping the clanger, but, you know, we were very proud to win a Sports Personality of the Year award after the 401 finished. And I remember standing up on that stage in front of the 50,000 people that were in the audience, knowing there were millions of people at home. And I just remember thinking to myself, what the hell am I doing here?
Really?
Yeah. You know, whereas, you know, nobody else thought that. I did, you know. But that, going back to what you were saying about that almost being built into you as a child through the experiences you've had, it does. It consistently affects everything that I do. I think what I've come to do with it is I've come to manage it. It's never going to go away. It's never going to go away. And I think I've accepted that. But I think what I tend to do is I tend to go back to what's important to me. And actually, if the understanding is there in myself that what I'm doing is not just right for me, but right for others, you know, it's not hurting anybody, it's going to make a difference, and it's a positive thing, then that's the only moral compass I can go by. There's been many situations I've been stood up thinking, yeah, I don't belong here, I'm not worthy.
I recorded another podcast with a TV presenter and celebrity publicist, a guy called Nick Ead, yesterday. And he was talking about he was head judge on Project Runway on Sky One and all these things. And he was like, I've been to a place where I'm presenting in front of millions of people, yet I never felt good enough to be there. Therefore, it's completely damaged my mental health. It's fascinating that you're stood on a stage at BBC Sports Personality of the Year in front of 50,000 people winning an award, and you're like, what the hell am I doing here, having just run 401 marathons in 401 days for a great cause? It's extraordinary.
But I think, do you know what? And again, I think this is, you know, we view that as probably a bad thing. Mm. And actually, do you know what? I think in hindsight, I don't see it necessarily as a bad thing. And that might be a bit controversial, I don't know. But there's almost this over-arrogance you can have in yourself, you know, like you belong everywhere and you deserve everything. And I'm not that, but I'm also not the other extreme. I feel now I'm kind of quite set in the middle. I appreciate the situations that I'm in now. I appreciate what I do and what I get and, you know, the people that I meet. And I think that's been the change. That's come by, you know, me figuring out what I've wanted to do in my life. And, you know, we use the strap line, finding you happy. And it has been that, you know, people spend their entire lives trying to figure out what makes them happy in life. And actually, they don't really get to that point. For me, you know, that point started for me at the age of 29. And it took a good 4 or 5 years to really find that point where, do you know what, I could turn around and go, do you know what, I'm really happy. And I genuinely am happy with my life. And with that, that brings you confidence. It brings you a heightened level of self-esteem. It also, it stops you from being a bit of a twat as well to other people. Because you also find there's a lot of people that are very uncomfortable with themselves, that overplay certain things, and they can kind of come across as a bit of a prat.
Yeah.
And, you know, we as human beings, we have that natural ability to be able to, you know, tell if someone's bullshitting. You know, the little spidey senses start coming up and you start going, oh, yeah, I know. But, you know, I saw it in the corporate world that I used to work in. You know, you used to have Billy Big Balls, you know, there in the sales meetings going, well, I've, you know, got this month and, you know, I'm the best salesman on the planet. And you're just a bit like, oh, you're a knob. But it's because of the insecurities that person has. And I think what we should all really kind of fight for is finding this almost calmness and stillness in being comfortable with who we are. And that is always a struggle with men because, you know, we have stereotypes to fight.
You started also noticing, I mean, compounding the whole bullying experience, started to notice that you weren't attracted to women. Presumably at the age of 13, you were actually attracted to men. Yeah. And that had a huge impact on your mental health. And as you've talked about before, this feeling of having to hide who you were. Ultimately, that period of 5 years from the age of 13 resulted in you at 18, literally being in a place where you were on the precipice of taking your own life. Like in the days leading up to that moment where you've taken that knife from the school canteen, and you realize, okay, this is the best way out. What was going through your mind?
What was going through my mind? Do you know what? It was almost, I didn't think about doing it the 2 days, 3 days leading up. It was almost a very kind of, you know, immediate decision to do when I'm sat down at the dinner table on the Sunday. I think it had been a collection of, you know, the past 5 years, 8 years it would have been at that point, through, you know, there's only so much abuse that somebody can take. There's only so much being put down somebody can take. And actually, I almost reserved myself during those 8 years to the fact that my life wasn't my own. It was other people's, and I just had to get through it by doing things that they wanted me to do, and that was it. But that's exhausting when you're trying to pretend to be something you're not, which, you know, I guarantee near enough every single man can probably relate to this. We do pretend to be something we're not half the time, because whether or not it's a stereotype or whether or not it's because we feel we need to be that way or whether or not we feel it's a weakness. But, you know, for me, it was, I covered up the fact that I was gay because I felt that I couldn't be that person because society didn't allow me to be, or I thought society didn't allow me to be because the environment that I was in didn't allow me to be. I knew my parents would never have an issue with it, but I was too afraid to tell my parents because the way I'd been brainwashed at the school was that, even though deep down in my heart of hearts I knew that they were all right about it or would be all right about it, I never quite knew whether or not they would. And because I didn't have that support network in place, I couldn't afford to lose them. So that's why I didn't tell them. But yeah, I think the days leading up to me trying to take my own life the first time round, and it was a serious attempt. It wasn't a cry for help. It was a genuine want to end it all. I didn't really think much about it. It was that point in the dining hall when I looked at the knife and I thought, you know what? I don't want to be here anymore. It was almost kind of like this sense of it, everything made sense. It just, everything fell into place. And I went back up into my bedroom and I shut the door and I locked it, because you get a lock when you're in the sick form on your door. And I tidied my room. And, you know, a lot of people, when I tell this story, they kind of think, well, why did you tidy your room? That's a bit weird. And for me, it was, I had had no control for 8 years as to how I led my life. If I was going to end my life, I was going to end it in the way that I wanted to end it. And actually tidying my room meant that the people who I knew loved me wouldn't have had to go through the, you know, pain and suffering of having to sort out my room. It was all there. It was all sorted. It was all packed away. You know, I wrote my note, which was very short and very concise, and I sat on the bed and I did it. And a lot of people think, oh, you know, suicide is it's a selfish thing, because you leave behind people that absolutely love you and adore you. And but when you're in that position, and you're this will probably resonate with you, but and anyone listening that's kind of been through similar things, you don't think of that. If anything, you think the opposite, and you think, well, if I'm not here, then I'm not going to be a burden on these people. I'm not going to. And it's almost like completely, you think completely the opposite to people that love you. And that's where the understanding isn't, it's not there. Mm. It's not a selfish act whatsoever. And I think this is where, unfortunately, we need to kind of get a bit more awareness about it, because it's about making sure that both men and women don't get to this point. Because for somebody to get to that point in their life where the only thing worth doing to them in their head mentally is to end it, that's not right. That's not right at all.
Fascinating. Yeah, you talk quite openly about, and I actually I talk quite a lot about how we as people go through the system of life, which is, okay, you go to school. About 16 or 17, a teacher tells you, and after this, I want to come on to lead into 401. Mm. But go through school, 16 or 17, teachers are like, right, what are you going to do with a career? You're like, I don't fucking know. And then you go to university, you probably don't actually study anything to do with any sort of a degree that's got any relevance. For me, it was politics. I'm not doing anything in politics anymore, or at all. And then you go into the big wide world, and it's like, okay, well, life is set out for you. It is, you get a career, you find what you're going to do for the next 40 years. You then find a partner, probably a wife. As you've talked about, society is skewed often against gay people, lesbians, etc. And you find a wife, you have kids, a good car, and that's it. That is life. What advice do you give to people now, knowing that actually that's often all bollocks?
Exactly that advice. Bullshit. A happy life is the life that you want to lead. Mm. And when I say you want to lead, I don't mean what your parents want you to lead, or your friends want you to lead, or what you think you want to lead. It's what you in your soul want to lead. That is a happy life, and there is no template for that. Yes, you know, there's this archaic template of like what you've just said: get the nice car, get the house, get the good, you know, job, have the wife or the husband, you know, have kids, have the dogs, the cats, you know, the final salary pension scheme, if those bloody things exist anymore. But, you know, it's almost this whole thing of tick box exercise of like, to be successful in life, I must have all of this. And when I'm successful, I'm also told if I'm successful, I'm therefore happy. Mm. And obviously we all aspire to be happy. But most of the time, people chasing all of that, and I'm not saying it's everyone, because there are people in this world that actually, that is what makes them happy, and we have to respect that, and that's fine. And that's what motivates them, and that's what kind of keeps them alive and going. But for a lot, because society says that is success, therefore that means happiness, we all aspire to do what other people suggest we should do. We're finding, though, in the younger generations now, and this is one thing I'm really excited about, is the fact that the younger generation, they're more headstrong. They're more kind of focused on figuring out the things that make them happy in their life. You know, yes, they deal with, you know, heightened issues around mental health and suicide and, you know, the challenges that people face with social, you know, not that I think all that is, you know, a bad thing. You know, unfortunately, we as a society haven't moved at the same rate that social has, and we have to catch up. But I think to suggest the way we've lived our life to somebody of a younger generation, I think that's quite a difficult thing to do. For me, I was always told by the people I went to school with, by them, by my peers at school, by my teachers, never by my parents, that if I wanted to be successful, I needed to be working for a top 100 company in the UK. And I got there, you know, and I got a really good wage, and I got a car, I got married to a woman, yes. You know, but I was happy. And yeah, it kind of all came to an abrupt finish when I ended up in the local hospital in Bristol.
Having had a stroke.
Yeah.
I mean,
what
do you put that down to? Because actually from like, yeah, I was going to say stress and pressure.
They couldn't find anything. You know, I think it was quite clear to see that I was depressed, but because I'd normalized everything internally from the way, you know, I'd hid everything. I knew I was gay. I'd known I was gay since I was 13 years old. But I also reserved myself to the fact that I couldn't be that person. So therefore I would play this other role. And I just got very good at it. You know, it doesn't mean I was disingenuous or anything like that. It was just my choice to be this other person. And I wasn't all, you know, everything wasn't bad. Everything wasn't gloomy. I didn't wake up every morning and go, oh God, I hate my life. You know, and I loved the life I had because, you know, that's what I'd earned. But what I didn't have was true happiness. And I didn't realize until I had true happiness how much I'd missed.
Mm. And this started the hilarious thing about your story is that you've had this stroke.
Many hilarious things about this story.
Yeah. You've got married, and then at 29, you get divorced. You're like, I'm not
30.
Okay. 30, you get divorced. You realize that you've just got to live the life that you actually want to live. Mm. And you weren't interested in fitness whatsoever. Not the thought of putting one step in front of the other at pace is not really a bar walking, like it's not really your thing. And then I was
a 40 a day smoker, you know. Wow. I used to drink myself under the table every day because I was clearly depressed.
Yeah, masking the pain that you're going through.
Yeah. And obviously it was a friend of mine that introduced me to running. I remember when she introduced me, it was over a pint of cider in a pub in Bristol. Why didn't you come to my running club? And I just remember spitting my pint out thinking, this is the most ridiculous thing you could ever say to me. Do you not see me? You know, I was 17 and a half stoner. I didn't exercise. I smoked all the time. I used to drive past people with a fag hanging out the car window, looking at runners, thinking, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
But I went. And you know, without all the cliches in the world, you know, it changed my life.
Genuinely. What was it about running that changed your life?
Well, it wasn't an immediate thing. I'll put that straight out there.
Okay, you know? Good. Okay.
I felt like I was going to die the first time I did it. You had these preconceptions that, you know, I was rocking up to a running club. I thought everyone there was going to be skinny. I thought they were all going to be really fast. I thought they were all going to, like, look at me and think, what the fuck are you doing here? You know, all those feelings that I had at school. You know, I was never a sporty kid at school because a lot of my buddies were sports people. You know, I know you played rugby, and my brother was a professional rugby player, so he was kind of more in the popular crowd at school because that was the crowd that was popular at my school, the rugby, the hockey, the you know, that side of things. I wasn't that. So I avoided sport like the plague. But yeah, when it came to this, I remember having all these misconceptions about it. And remember walking in absolutely terrified, thinking my heart was going to beat too fast and I was going to die. They were going to laugh at me. I was going to get left behind. You know, all those horrible feelings. And most people do experience this. I put my 50p in the pot and I turned around and I literally just scanned the room. And there must have been about 200, 300 people in the room.
Wow.
And I remember focusing on this group in the corner. And it was the Couch to 5K group. And I went and joined them and it turned out they were doing the 5K that night.
And so you did it?
Yeah, so I did it. And it bloody hurt. From my ankles to my knees to my hips, everything. Even the rolls of fat around me hurt. And I just remember thinking to myself, people enjoy this. But actually internally, inside, it also on the other side gave me this feeling of feeling alive for the first time in what, going on 20 years?
It's a long time.
Yeah. And I hadn't realised how dead I'd felt inside for so long. And weirdly enough, the pain that I felt, and it probably sounds really sadistic, and I don't know if anybody else felt this way, but it almost lit a fire inside me. It wasn't a love of, oh my God, this is the best thing since sliced bread and I'm going to do this every single day. It was a kind of fire inside going, well, if I've managed to do that, what else can I do? And then I went back the following week and I just kept going back. And, I never grew every week. You know, there were weeks where I couldn't be bothered and, you know, everything was crap. But what I think I used running to do was to kind of help me overcome a lot of the challenges that I thought I was facing in my life. Running my first 10K, my first half marathon, my first marathon. You know, these were things I would never have dreamt about doing. I used to watch the London Marathon all the time and think, you know, oh my God, how amazing would it be to do that? Did you ever sign up? No, you bloody didn't. You know, you'd always find an excuse. I don't have time to train, or I don't have this, or I wouldn't enjoy it. And actually giving myself the permission to go, yeah, I'm going to do that. I remember my first marathon in Brighton, crossing that finishing line, face planting on the finishing line, being dragged off into the finishing area, being given a foil blanket, a bottle of water that I couldn't even open because my brain didn't work.
And an oxygen tank.
Near enough.
Yeah. And then a defibrillator.
And then the hospital. And yeah, all of this, you know. But then somebody put a medal around my neck.
Yeah. And that was it.
Yeah. I just remember thinking to myself that this medal signifies something that I never thought I could ever do. And with that came a barrel load of confidence. And I think I was ready to grab hold of it and just, no pun intended, but run with it.
And here we go with the 401 challenge, which by anybody's standards is completely mental. But actually, now you've thought about it now makes quite a lot of sense, because in the run up to the 401 challenge, the 2 years before, you'd run 30 marathons, right, leading up to it.
Yes. Yeah. So I ran my first one in Brighton in 2013, ran Amsterdam in the same year. And then in 2014, I think I went and did 18 or 19, I think it was.
You knew you were capable of doing it. But
yeah.
Where does the 401 come from? Because actually, you'd kind of look at it and be like, okay, well, 365 marathons for every single day of the year, that in itself is punchy. But then you've gone one better in 401. Like, what's the mentality around 401?
And
let's move into that.
Yeah. I wish I could say that there was some real synonymous, like I was born at 1 minute past four, you know, or on the 1st of April or something. But no, it's nothing like that. I was doing a kind of quite an analytical job. So I like my numbers and stuff like that. And my brain kind of works like that. When we came up with the idea of the 401, and it was, I looked at what other people had kind of done out there. I looked at what I wanted to raise money for, and I looked at how much money I wanted to raise. And we came up with £250,000. And I kind of thought, well, we've kind of got to do something quite big here to raise £250,000. I can't just go run one marathon, which is big for, you know, loads and loads of people. But to get £250,000 off of that isn't going to happen. That's the reality. So I need to do something huge and probably bigger than I'd ever done in my entire life. we came up with the concept of running back-to-back marathons. And then I thought, oh, well, what's the biggest thing anybody's done with that? So we looked at what the world record was. And at the time, the world record stood at, it was 53. I believe a Japanese guy that had run around a running track for 53 days running a marathon every day. And I just thought, I can't do that. You know, I just mentally in my head, I wouldn't be able to do that. But then I looked, and actually there were other people that had done more, but it hadn't counted because of the rules of the Guinness World Record and things like that, the different categorizations. And I just decided to myself, you know, why am I doing this? And it was to raise the money for the charity. And I said, do I want a Guinness World Record? And I thought, no, not really. So what I did was I looked at what these other people had done. And it turned out that I found kind of a couple of people that had done 100. I found some that had done 250. I found a couple of people that had done 365. I found a couple of claims of somebody doing 607 and then somebody doing 1,000. But we couldn't verify the last two. So the only ones we could really verify were the ones won every day for a year. So I rounded it up to 400 because I thought, nice round number. And then I went out to America in 2015, the beginning of 2015, and I did 7 marathons in 7 days across 7 US states from St. Louis down to New Orleans, down the Mississippi River, and it was the best experience ever. I absolutely loved it. And I got to run with this amazing guy called Larry Macon, and I still believe he is, but don't take my word for this, but he is the guy that's run the most amount of marathons in a lifetime. He was on 1,800 at the time. And this guy was incredible, this lanky Texan in his 70s at the point. And I remember just telling him what I was planning on doing. And, you know, typical American fashion, awesome, brilliant, so supportive. And he went, why don't you add a victory lap? And I went, what do you mean? He went, well, why didn't you have a victory lap at the end? Why didn't you end it off with a big event? And I kind of thought, the more I thought about it, I went, sounds like a great idea. Mm-hmm. So when we get home...
Once you've done 400, what's one doing another?
401. Yeah. And actually, when you look at the 401, the final day was the big finishing event. It was the event in Bristol where we invited people from all around the UK that had run with me and people that hadn't to come and join in on this final day. And it was amazing. We ended up with about 800 people on the last day, you know, running between Bristol and Portishead, where I live now, on the Somerset coast.
So. I want to talk about like the mentality of that 401, because by anybody's standards, running back-to-back marathons for 401 days, it shatters their body. Yeah. What were the worst parts of that? And mentally, how did you prepare for it?
So the worst parts were day 1 to 50. I'm not going to lie. the first 50 days were hell. But when you understand the body and you kind of understand how your mind can affect your body, your body will always adapt to what it is you're asking it to do. That's how we learn to walk from crawling. That's how we grow. That's how we get better at certain things. And more we practice stuff. So as long as I figured out that as long as I wasn't putting my body to exhaustion every single day, I would give myself time to recover, to be able to then go the following day. And don't get me wrong, we didn't plan all this in the very beginning. This was learned as we were running. The first 7 days I went, you know, my left knee doubled in size within the first 4 days. I went over on it actually in the town I live in here, because we left Bristol. It was day 4 when we were here in Portishead, and we were going to be working our way down the kind of Somerset coast through Weston and down to Taunton and then Exeter and Plymouth and then all the way down towards like Land's End. And I remember day 4, my knee doubled in size. I ended up getting severe shin splints. I believe I fractured my big toe. So this was all within the first week. I then lost control of the van in Exeter that I was living in. I forgot to put the handbrake on, and it rolled across the Sainsbury's car park in Sutton Industrial Estate into a tree, which, you know, and this was in the first 7 days. So, you know, but then I kind of, the way I thought about it was, what more can go wrong? So, and I suppose this is the way I thought about it all the way through. I kind of thought, let's take every day as it comes. You know, my dad, he had, you know, come out of retirement, and he was working with running clubs all around the UK, which meant that, you know, when I got to a particular area, there was a route planned, and actually there were people to run with me. And that was really good for my mental health, because I don't like to run on my own.
So do you have people running with you on every marathon?
Everyone apart from six. There were three in the UK, three in England, three in Scotland. Everyone in Wales was covered by somebody. But yeah, there was, the first day was, funnily enough, Exeter on day seven. I didn't have anybody running with me there. I think I got lost. 30 degrees, ran 30 miles. That's when the van thing happened. You just kind of go, I suppose you compare it to what you've been through in your past. And for me, I've been through hell for a number of years. And actually, this was my choice to do this. And this was my want. And I wasn't about to give up. You know, I'd put a lot of effort in. I'd sold everything that I owned, you know, bought a camper van. And I in a lot of people's eyes, I'd given up everything, but I'd given up nothing. I just switched my priorities. That's all I'd done. And come hell or high water, I was going to get to the end. And as I went on, my body adapted and it stopped becoming a physical thing and started to becoming more of a mental thing. So then it was up to me to figure out, how do I keep my brain, how do I keep my mind healthy throughout this entire time?
And what were the key takeaways? What were the number of things?
So again, it was just understanding me as a person. And it came down to the fact that I found something that I truly loved, truly made me happy. I was doing something very pure and actually was doing it for the right reasons. I wasn't doing it for fame or fortune or anything like that. I massively failed if I was doing that. but for me, I like people. And actually, funnily enough, even though all the crap I've been through in my life before, I actually really like to be surrounded by people and to talk and to, you know, listen and, you know, engage. So actually having people come and join me was amazing because I got to meet lots of new people. I love to travel and explore, you know, go back to when before I was 0 to 10 years old, I traveled the world. So, you know, there was that excitement of being able to see the UK. So there was that as well. So waking up in a different place every single day, it was like almost this relentless adventure, this kind of want to change something and bring awareness to something that was really, truly emotional for me. That was exciting. I love food. You know, I had to eat 6,000 calories a day. I hadn't realized this up until around day 50. I was still eating about half of that because I was trying to, you know, I hadn't had a nutritionist or anything like that. You know, I was just kind of learning off of what I thought I knew. And I lost so much weight. I lost 17 kilos within the first 50 days. And that affected me mentally. But then it was after that point where I decided that actually I was just going to eat what the hell I wanted. So I just had a burger. And for me, I used to then include food stops in my run. So I become quite synonymous with running for coffee and cake. You know, flat whites, cake, chicken, you know, a full, you know, English breakfast, you know, halfway around a marathon. But it was, for me, that was an enjoyable thing. The sociability of running was what I truly loved. It wasn't the speed or the pace. And actually, do you know what? That then became very conducive in other people. And we had lots of people from lots of abilities come to run further than they'd ever run before, or just see how far they could get, because they knew it wasn't going to be fast. It became very accessible. And we had people from the age of 4 all the way up to 82. You know, we had, I think it was 1,600 people ran further than they'd ever run before, and 500 of those which ran their first marathon with me, and never thinking that they'd ever do it, of which a handful of those were people that just rocked up in the morning, never thinking they'd ever run a marathon in their life, and did it off no training. But what I found was, it was the mental aspect of feeding my soul every day through not just food, but the interactions with people, the excitement and the adventures to where I was, but also the reasons behind why I was doing it. It almost became very simple. It's almost a little bit like lockdown, dare I say. The world became very quiet during lockdown. And actually, I think, you know, there was obviously two different sides to lockdown. You know, the horrificness of people losing their lives and family members losing their lives, which is horrible. Then on also the other side, you know, you found a lot more people became at peace with themselves and kind of almost quietened down the world's, you know, anger. That's kind of come back, unfortunately. But I found with regard to the challenge that it's almost like I quietened down my life and it allowed me, it allowed my head to just stay in the game. I'm not saying that it happened every day. You know, there were days I woke up and thought, oh God, why am I doing this?
I don't know if you've come across a guy called Luke Tabersky before.
Yeah, I know Luke.
Yeah, so he came on the podcast and we sat down and we did 2.5 hours and he had this wonderful way of, I don't know if you've read his book and watched his documentary, but he had this wonderful way of talking about every single morning when, yeah, he didn't quite do 401 marathons in 401 days, but he had to do double marathons and do the ultimate triathlon of 2,000 kilometers. And he was like, I'd wake up every single morning and yeah, it was fucking horrible. But then I'd just be like, I chose to do this and let's put one foot in front of the other. Now, was your mindset, let's say, let's take you back to, I don't know, day 260. I mean, by anybody's standard, you've done 260 days and that is hard. What was your mindset waking up? Did you have a routine? So like Luke, yeah, getting up and be like, okay, I chose to do this. I'm going to put one foot in front of the other and then I'm going to put another foot in front of the other. What was your mindset waking up?
I think day 260, funnily enough, was the Milton Keynes Marathon.
Really? Ironically.
So yeah, there were a lot of people on that day, but no, I get where you're going. For me, it was the people I surrounded myself by, not just my team, the team of people that were kind of supporting me. So like my mum, my dad, my now husband, Kyle, and a friend of mine, Tolu. It was a small team. They didn't travel with me, but they kind of were satellite. But for me, the kind of mindset every day was, I didn't struggle most days. I actually really genuinely bloody enjoyed it. I felt that an absolute privilege to do what I did. Genuinely, I loved it. But on the days where I really struggled, I remember ringing Kyle up, my husband, and we'd made a pact in the very beginning that if I ever rang him up and said, oh, why am I doing this? He'd just tell me to hang up the phone and ring him back when I felt better.
Really?
Yeah, because... And almost he it's that's his mentality, you know. It's like, well, this was your choice, you know.
Precisely.
Go away, dare I say, grow a pair, and come back, and you know, talk to me when you're in a better mood. And I'm not talking about manning up or anything like that. I think I didn't need people around me that pandered to me when I felt down. I needed people to remind me almost as to why I was doing what I was doing. I managed to do that on a daily basis for myself through all the different aspects that motivated me. But there obviously were days when we need the help of others, and there's nothing wrong with that. And I did. I got it from the people around me because they loved me and they cared for me and they wanted me to succeed. Mm. So, yeah.
Did you Luke talks about this post the ultimate triathlon and spending, I think he spent 3 years leading up to that, planning and preparing. There was this huge crash mentally. I experienced it as well, like doing things. I got a huge high and then a massive low on it. Like, did you experience that post the 41 days? Was there depression or?
Yeah, hugely. I think, you know, we knew that there was going to be an element of this because I'd seen it in my brother. You know, my brother played professional rugby from, you know, he started rugby when he was 4 and ended, I think, in his mid-20s. And, you know, he played for Bath and, you know, a couple of the big premier teams. And he ended up leaving because of injury. And so it was through no choice really of his own. And I saw how that mentally affected him because he felt like he hadn't achieved what he basically wanted to achieve in his sport. So we kind of knew that the logic behind doing something every day, this routine, and you see it in people that, you know, work every day of their life and then retire. You know, there's this almost kind of like, well, what, I've still got many years left now. Well, what's my new purpose? And that was the key for us, that after the 401, I'd spent 5 years getting to this point. And then I'd done it. And then it was almost waking up the following day. It was like, well, what the hell now? you know, and there was no purpose. I tried to go out for a run the following day. I think I managed 6 miles and just thought, I cannot be asked.
Extraordinary. You've just done 401 marathons in 401 days and you go for a run the next day.
And I was like, I just can't be asked, because in my head, it had gone. I'd hit my goal. I'd achieved what I set out to achieve. We'd raised £250,000. I think it was £330,000 we ended on. We'd, you know, raised awareness of issues around bullying and sexuality in the UK. We visited so many schools. We'd done everything we set out to achieve. So we're waking up the following morning, there was nothing more to achieve. So I felt very lost. But, you know, that was fine for about 2 weeks. And then it started to really affect me, not just mentally, but physically. My body, my heart would jump to about 180 beats a minute, just like that, for no apparent reason. And then I wouldn't be able to sleep. So it would mostly happen when I was going to bed. So then I wouldn't sleep. I would get quite anxious. I'd get quite het up, and almost that feeling where you feel like your skin's crawling. And then I couldn't sleep because my mind was busy. And then I start to worry about, well, actually, I don't have a job. So what am I going to do? You know, how am I going to survive? We need to bring money in. You know, we just moved in together. Me and my husband had just moved in together. And it's like I've been in this bubble for 401 days. And then suddenly I was now back in real life. And it was kind of, everybody was still very praising, and they were like, oh my God, this is amazing what you're doing. And the press, it never really stopped. And that was fine. And it was, we learned to deal with all of that. But for me, behind the scenes, I was really suffering. You know, I didn't want to talk about running. I didn't want to talk about what I'd achieved. But yeah, everybody wanted me to. I lost the love for running. I really did. And it's almost like I lost the love for something that had helped me become the person I'd become. And that was really difficult to swallow, because running had been that thing in my life that gave me confidence. It had given me self-esteem, and it had helped me deal with very difficult moments in my life. And actually, I no longer had that. I couldn't just put my trainers on and go out for a run, and I called it my fighting time. You know, my mind would be all jumbled, and I'd go for a run, and then by the time I came back, everything would be sorted out, and I'd be able to think clearly again. It didn't do that for me anymore, because I'd basically run it all out of me, you know? So I had no longer had a coping mechanism, and therefore my mental health started to diminish quite quickly. That, in turn, with the lack of sleep. I didn't sleep for about a month to 2 months. And then the doctor ended up putting me on antidepressants. Which, again, I felt a stigma going on.
Yeah. What was your experience of antidepressants?
Do you know why? It was a really good experience.
Okay.
Really good experience, because I bloody needed them. And there's no shame in admitting that I bloody needed them. You know, the doctors that we have here in Portishead, the ones that I went to the local medical centre, they were amazing. You know, and I know a lot of people have very different experiences, but I had a really good experience. And I think off the back of that, that's why I've ended up becoming now the person that I am now, and in the position I'm in now. And it's, you know,
What do you mean by that?
Well, they listened to me. They listened to me, and they recognized what I was saying to them. They genuinely wanted to help me. They worked with me on a program to help me overcome what I was going through at the time. You know, there was this real want to really help. And I got put on the right tablets, and I managed to sleep. And God, when you don't sleep and then sleep, it's amazing how much clearer you become in your head. Yeah, okay, the antidepressants dumbed me down, and they, you know, sorry, not dumbed me down, that's the wrong word, numbed me. You know, I didn't feel highs, I didn't feel lows, I kind of felt in the middle. But what that did was, in my head, logically, it gave me the opportunity to heal internally. And over a period of time, it was about a period of 3 months, me and my other half, we were talking, and I came up with the next purpose. I came up with a new purpose in my life, and that was the charity that we now run.
I want to talk more about this, and I appreciate we don't have too much time, but I want to come on to what you're doing now and the new challenge, because it's absolutely fascinating. And then I want to just talk about like limitations, because I think you've got a really powerful opinion on that. So what are you doing now? You've set out to do, it's 52, am I right in thinking it's 52 marathons across 52 states, right?
So this is the USA Challenge. So, yeah. So the USA Challenge, it's actually a 14,000 mile journey, or feat of endurance, dare we say. It's 14,000 miles over 104 days across America. And we visit all 50 US states.
Right.
So these are, we're not visiting Puerto Rico or, well, we are going to Washington, D.C., but they're not classified as a state. But we are going to Alaska. We are going to Hawaii. And wow. The aim is to run a marathon in every one of the state capitals. So from the 48 lowers to the two additionals, Alaska and Hawaii. And it's to cycle between them, all within 104 days. And the aim is to raise £500,000 for the 401 Foundation, which is the legacy to the 401 Challenge. And that's the mental health charity that supports community projects around the UK in building confidence and self-esteem, but also giving people within the community the ability to support people with mental well-being. It's something that's extremely, I'm extremely passionate about. We started handing out grants at the beginning of the year, which is amazing. We've got a huge amount of support in the people that support us in what we're trying to achieve. And I'm ready now to do the second one. And this second one's going to have a profound effect on the foundation going forward. And it's going to allow us to achieve the things that we want to achieve to make sure the foundation's sustainable for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years to come.
What do you want to achieve?
What do I want to achieve? Well, at the moment, it's about...
Well, let me change that question. What do you want to achieve personally, and actually, what do you want the foundation to achieve?
I've achieved what I want to achieve personally, to be honest with you.
So everything in life is now a bonus.
Dare I say, if I died tomorrow, I'd be a happy man.
I want to come on to that question, actually. Yeah, so save your answer.
I have a plan to die tomorrow. And, but I've married the man of my dreams, and I have an amazing family. I have amazing friends, and you know, I have a job, two jobs that I absolutely love. I run a commercial business. The 401 Challenge is now a commercial business. You know, I get to go around the world delivering talks to people and talking to young kids. You know, I'm developing a well-being program, which hopefully will be in 2,000 schools by, you know, the end of next month. That will hopefully get 1 million children involved in our next project. This is my life now, and I absolutely love it. So personally, you know, I've achieved everything that I want to achieve. I suppose I just want to make sure that I remain true to myself, and I make sure that, you know, 20, 30 years down the line, I'm still happy. And understanding that certain things that make me happy might change. It's not going to be the same thing right the way through. Mm. And that's something that I didn't know before, and it's okay to know that now. But professionally, you know, I want the foundation to be handing out £1.5 million worth of grants supporting 750 small community projects around the UK every year. You know, that's what I want. I want to build an online database of localized mental health initiatives that people can type their postcode in and they can literally find the help and support that they need. Now the NHS, they do something very similar, but we're talking small initiatives like yoga groups or meditation or running or, you know, craft making or pottery. You know, we're talking really bespoke type things, because mental health, it's different for everybody, and everybody is different in themselves, so therefore the treatment of it is different. It's not just one size fits all. We're looking at building an impact tool which will allow our donors to be able to understand exactly where their money goes and what it goes to support, and also then connecting them with the local community projects. So not just financially supporting them, they can support them through their experience and their profession, so to speak, because we also have learned that small community projects, it's not just money they need, it's community support and it's knowledge and, you know, it's expertise. And then on top of that, we want to build a 200-strong ambassador force covering all 96 counties of the UK, including Northern Ireland, that will raise the awareness of the foundation, but also work with local community projects, promote the foundation within those communities so that those projects then know they can apply for grants from us. So, yeah, it's a lot that we want to achieve within the next 5 years. And then ultimately after that, we want to we want to open up the foundation in America and do the same over there.
It's extraordinary.
So I feel I don't have any limits anymore. And that's one thing that
you've segued wonderfully into my next bloody question. So thank you for doing my job. Let's talk about limiting belief systems, because you've been plagued with this, or you were plagued with this, right? And it's something that I suffer with, and I'm learning how to overcome. It is a very long process. It doesn't just come with like one or two therapy sessions, which is what I went into it expecting. Actually, this could take a very long time to rewire our unconscious mind, essentially.
It
is all in our head.
It is, but it's also recognizing the fact that we can't do this on our own.
Yeah.
And for me, I had therapy. I talked about my issues with the cancer even prior to the 401, and I managed to deal with a lot of the stuff that I've been through. And it didn't solve everything, but it brought me to a peaceful place where I felt I was ready to take the next step. And then obviously it meant that I was in the right place to do the 401. With regard to now, for me, I surround myself by people that don't necessarily think the same as me, but they share the same moral compass as me. So we're all fighting, or we're all heading towards the same goal. You know, I've got an amazing team of people that I work with, and actually we're all extremely passionate about getting the foundation and getting the challenge to the point that we want to get it to. And actually that, especially with the board, the foundation board that we have, you know, the amount of times I go to them with a set of crazy ideas that to most people would absolutely blow their minds and just think, what the hell, this guy's nuts. But they don't. What they do is they say, that's amazing. Right, let's look at how we can do that. And that's what I think has helped me overcome the limits that I used to put on myself. And I don't see any limits anymore. I really don't. As long as it's done in the right way, it's done legally, it doesn't hurt anybody, and there's transparency in it, then that's fine.
You talk about finding true happiness as well. You talk about identity equals true happiness for you. Why?
It's knowing who you are, and it's being comfortable with who you are. You know, and I am. I completely am. I don't think there's anything more I can really say about it. I genuinely... they call it congruence, don't they? How you feel on the inside versus how you behave on the outside. And we're all, you know, we're all responsible, I suppose, for how we feel at times, but also we're responsible for actually portraying truly how we feel at times. You know, when you look at social sometimes and you have people that they just post the good stuff and they don't post the bad stuff, and then everyone goes, oh well, I wish you were a bit more honest, and then you get somebody posting all the bad stuff and they're like, oh god, they're just moaning. You know, it's kind of almost, there needs to be this inner thing within us to not just respect the bad stuff, but also understand that, you know, we need to be responsible to do that as well. So for me, congruence is an important thing. I behave exactly how I feel on the inside. If I'm moody, I will be moody. If I'm happy, I will be happy. I don't cover anything up anymore. And I think what that's allowed me to do is feel right in myself and be who I truly am, which is the person you see in front of you right now. So
fascinating. I've got five quick fire questions for you.
Oh God, I'm so bad at quick fire questions.
Okay.
Right, okay, here goes.
Right. Number one, what's your favorite book and why?
Oh God. Can I say my own? No, sorry. The 401 available on Amazon. Yeah, sorry.
I'll put it in the show notes. Don't worry.
No. I joke. Ironically, I don't read books. I'm extremely dyslexic and I struggle to read books. I don't even read audiobooks. So I don't know what the answer to that question. I'd be lying if I gave you a favourite book.
What do you do then? Podcasts?
No, I don't. I work all the time, but I love what I do. So
yeah.
Most of my time I'm, you know, spent with my nose in a bloody spreadsheet.
So, right, okay. So yeah. Spreadsheet, what's your favourite spreadsheet and why?
Oh, mate, now you're starting. I could say all the formulas. Yes. Yeah.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Question number two. What lesson have you learned in your life that you know is true, but you kind of hate?
I don't even know. What? What lesson have I learned in life?
That you know is true, but you kind of hate?
That my other half is always right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is always right, which is a real pain in the ass.
Okay, interesting. Number three, and I'm sure you'll be able to answer this one. Your friend who's having a tough time at the moment picks up the phone. He rings you and says he's having a really, really bad day today. What do you say?
I just listen.
Mm.
Yeah. I think I ask him what I can do, what I can do to help. And yeah, I think the ball's, I think it's about, you know, we talk, it's funny, I talk about this a lot with teachers at schools that I visit, and also parents who ask me about their kids going through tough times at schools and what advice I would give. And actually, it's about how we create an environment, a safe environment for people to be able to pick up that phone or know they can come to you and talk about things and not feel judged. And it's the same.
I talk about it with businesses. It's fostering a culture of vulnerability.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So, yeah, the fact that they picked up the phone and they rang me is a good sign. So, yeah, it would just basically be a case of me listening and, you know, not necessarily offering advice, because, you know, most of the time people don't want that. They just want somebody to talk to, somebody to listen to them, and somebody not to judge. And you know what? That's sometimes really difficult to do in people, because a lot of people do inherently want to help. So therefore they start to give advice.
Sympathy versus empathy.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. Number four, when you're struggling with something, you're struggling yourself. What's your go-to? Who do you turn to? What do you do to improve things?
I go to a spreadsheet. I'm not going to lie. Honestly, this really? Is... Yeah, I really do. Yeah, I know. I'm an absolute nerd. Like, if I'm really struggling with something, like, if I'm struggling with something from a professional, or, you know, say, for instance, you know, we had a tough time during lockdown because we lost a lot of income through our business, and actually we almost went bankrupt, and, you know, we have obviously things to pay for, like rent and stuff like that. And I was thinking, oh my God, what are we going to do? You know, I always go to a planning mode. I then kind of take a step back and go, right, okay, let's plan this. And most of the time it's do a spreadsheet, and my other half absolutely, he takes the piss out of me for it, but, you know, it's helped us out many a time. But I think, for me, if from a personal point of view, I tend to go to my friends. Like, I don't have a lot of friends. What I have is a very close group of friends.
Mm.
But I know if I picked up the phone, they'd drop anything. And they know the same from us. And they're the people I tend to go to. I have a lot of people that I know, and a lot of acquaintances, and a lot of supporters. I wouldn't necessarily think about putting it out on social or anything like that. Not because I want to be disingenuous or anything. It's just, you know, I tend to go to my friends.
Interesting. It's funny, Sasa, your other half is like my other half. She's a lawyer, and she's very left-brained. I'm very right-brained. And the thought of, she loves T&Cs. Like, she goes on a website, she'll just go on terms and conditions for a laugh. And I'm like,
you need people like this in your life.
She runs the other side of my life. Yeah, and I'm like, this is genius. Number five, you're lying on your deathbed looking back at your life.
Mm-hmm.
What are you most proud of?
The 401 and the legacy that's been created of it.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, I will always be proud. It is inherently what my life is now about. And there are so many arms to it, and so many people involved in it, and so many people that have been affected by it. And you know, I'm not saying that's all down to me. I'm not, because I think one of the kind of really amazing things that came out of the 401, we call it planned flexibility. You know, we planned each of the routes, we planned the locations, we planned the people we were going to work with. But actually what became quite apparent was the fact that lots of people turned up on each of these days. I think it was about 13,500 in total by the end of it all. And everyone had a very different experience. The amount of stories you used to hear, the amount of times people used to open up, but there weren't any barriers. It was just almost like, I can talk to you about things I never ever talked to you about. And I used to just listen, you know, almost like counseling sessions most of the time, to be honest with you. Or they go on to run further than they'd ever run before. They go on to run their first marathon. It would then be the effect that that day then had on their life going forward. And it almost became a turning point for a lot of people in their life. But then what happened was, is those people then went on to do other things that then became turning points for other people in their life. And that's, I think, what we're proud of. The fact that, you know, and again, I use this analogy, but you throw a stone in a pond and it creates these ripples. Those ripples then became their own stones in their own ponds. And that's, you know, that to me is the definition of what being a human being is all about. We make this world a bit better than what it was when we came into it. That's the goal. So
that's amazing. Those quickfire questions are done, and that was a lovely end to those quickfire questions, you'll be pleased to know. Where can people find you, and how can people get involved in this? Because it is, I want to get involved myself, actually. So what can people do?
So I suppose the best way, really, where we tend to do a lot of our communication is through social media. Anything to do with the 401 challenge, which is the USA challenge next year, and currently the training for it, and things like this, they can go onto Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, and just look for the handle at the 401 challenge. If you want to learn about the foundation, it's just the 401 foundation on Facebook and Instagram, and 401 foundation on Twitter. We have the same URLs for the websites. I think that there's lots of ways in which people can get involved in this. You can buy the book, you buy that through our website, or you buy it through Amazon, whichever. I'd say follow us on social, to keep up to date with what we're doing. And then if there's anything along the way that you want to get involved with, just get in touch. We're always looking for fun, creative people that have a passion for what it is that we want to achieve. So, fabulous. As I said, we're about to launch a wellbeing program that will not just support young people, but also the likes of teachers, parents, and the wider school community in, you know, their journey back into school. And we're about to launch that at the end of this month, which is really exciting. So we potentially could end up with over 1,000 schools involved in our next project in America, which the impact of that could be up to 1 million people.
It's extraordinary. Really is. Yeah. Fabulous.
Yeah. Hopefully it'll all go to plan.
I know. I'm sure it will. You're going to be a huge success. Ben, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I mean, what a journey. I'm looking forward to keeping in touch with you. And promoting this, and thank you for being open about your journey and the extraordinary 401 challenge. I mean, wow, I pity your feet and your knees after that.
They're fine.
That itself is amazing.
No, they're fine. ITV made me take my shoes off on the last day to prove the fact that I'd not had any blisters. So not a single blister, not a single missing toenail. And then I go and stub my toe on a bed 2 weeks later and lose my toenail. Honestly, you can't plan it.
You can't make it up.
No.
Ben, thank you.
Thanks, James.
Take care.